And welcome back to CKUT's Off the Hour. This is your host, Mustafa Henaway, or for this segment of Off the Hour with Aaron Lakoff. And joined with me now, live and by phone, is two activists in both Toronto and Montreal who've worked tirelessly around the issues of social housing, the struggles against gentrification in Toronto and Montreal, and also anti-poverty struggles. Fred Burrell, who's with us in studio, who's a community organizer with Paupière, also the Southwest Solidarity Network, and with Aki Laville. And Lisa Schofield, who is the organizer at the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty. Thank you both for coming on CKUT's Off the Hour.
Hey. Hi, Moose. Hi, Fred. Thanks for having me.
And so the reason for having this segment, or one of the things that has become more and more pertinent and has become more and more front page, is the issue of gentrification, and particularly the issue of sort of this condo bubble that exists both in Toronto and Montreal. Currently, Toronto has the largest amount of condominium projects in North America. Montreal has the third, ahead of New York and just close to Boston. And it's become more and more of a crisis, as well as we've seen the availability of social housing, a crisis, and shelter closings in Toronto. Just wanted to get from the both of you a sense and sort of a picture of what gentrification actually is, how it works in both in Montreal and in Toronto. And maybe you can start with you, Fred, sort of what is the situation in terms of the housing crisis and what gentrification has looked like on the ground, especially where you work in the Southwest here in Montreal, a working class neighborhood in Montreal.
Sure. Well, I mean, in places like St. Henry and Little Burgundy, or across the canal in Côte-Saint-Paul, Villemar, Pointe-Saint-Charles, what gentrification has meant is both an economic progress, an economic process, and a public policy that essentially works towards the mass and intentional displacement of a variety of marginal populations. I say marginal in the socioeconomic sense, not in the sense of percentage of who lives there, because in fact that is the majority of the population in those neighborhoods, be it working class or unemployed folks or migrant populations. That has been carried out pretty systematically for about 10 to 15 years in those neighborhoods, which has resulted in a situation in which there is a systematic prioritization of the construction of condominiums, so private housing. So for people who have the means, to buy an apartment at $200,000, $300,000, $400,000, almost zero construction of any type of low-income housing or subsidized housing or even actually rental housing at all. Montreal, in general, as a city, has been in what we call a housing crisis since the year 2000, which means that the vacancy rate on the private rental market is somewhere at around 3% or less. And it's been this way, for about 13 years now in Montreal, which means that there's no place for people to live, and B, landlords essentially operate with impunity because there are long lists of people who are waiting to live in the available housing stock. At the same time, there has been, as I was mentioning, this systematic prioritization of condos, such as we've seen since 2005 in St. Henry alone the construction of about 3,000 condo units. And in the last 4 years, we're talking 34 social housing units. So, and only half of those, which are subsidized for people of low income. So, it's a clear process that is generated and controlled by developers and local municipal politicians, which at the same time comes with it a bunch of cultural and social shifts in the neighborhood such that the people who, you know, who have lived there for a long time, or even if they've just moved there, but, you know, move in move in networks of low-income people, start to find that the neighborhood is no longer a place where they can move about easily. You know, we see fancy businesses, people who don't live in the neighborhood coming to eat in these new restaurants. There's now, if you walk along Notre Dame, which is one of the kind of the main commercial artery in St. Henry, there's security cameras everywhere on every business. The police presence is ramped up. So essentially, gentrification in the neighborhoods where I work is an intentional process to drive out poor people.
And Lisa, if you can talk about, I mean, Toronto being sort of one of the front lines in terms of what sort of this model or new model of gentrification actually means, and OCAP's work very much focusing on the downtown east end of the city of Toronto, maybe if you can paint a picture of what gentrification has been carried out in Toronto.
Sure. So we focus mostly on the downtown east neighborhood, not to say that there's not gentrification happening in many of the other neighborhoods within Toronto, but the downtown east is where OCAP has about 20 years of history in organizing in this neighborhood. And it is a very poor community, historically a very poor community, and one of the poorest communities, you know, pan-Canadian. So it is where we have launched our campaigns, and what we're seeing in terms of gentrification in the neighborhood is, on, you know, the one side, we have on the east side of the downtown east, we have Regent Park community housing, which is the largest social housing, used to be, and was the first largest social housing complex in all of Canada, and that has systematically been destroyed under a revitalization program by the city. And a move by, you know, pseudo-leftist councillors deeming the term mixed-income neighborhoods and needing to launch mixed-income neighborhoods to root out crime and to increase people's ability to climb the ladder, whatever the ways that they frame it. So the Regent Park revitalization has taken place, is still undergoing, and has resulted in a massive displacement of people who were in those housing units, and was a project between the City of Toronto and private developers, was a co-sponsored project between them. And so we've seen condos go up in the area that people are to own, and then separate units that have been rebuilt that are meant to stay as housing. But the promises that were made in terms of how much would remain as housing has, of course, gone down. And so I think it's something like the only 20% is remaining as housing, and people have been displaced all over the city, which is a huge, huge tragedy. So that's on the east side of us, and that's the largest housing complex. And then what we see in the center of Dundas and Sherbourne, which is a real vital corner for services, homeless services in the city of Toronto, we have a lot of drop-ins. We have shelters. The largest men's hostel in Canada is just, you know, on George Street, right around from the corner of Dundas and Sherbourne. So it's a really vital, vital center, and we're seeing the encroachment of gentrification into the corner, and we're seeing condos popping up all around the corner of Dundas and Sherbourne, and massive projects that there's no mechanism to stop on the city level. So even, I'm not sure how it works in Montreal, but even if the local councillor, which is not the case for us, the local councillor is in, for the most part, in favor of this development, but even if the local councillor was to attempt to put some halt on it or raise some questions around the lack of even a quota system within new developments, there's not even a quota system of how much should be housing and how much is for private use or ownership. So even if the councillor was to raise those questions, it usually would get overturned by the municipal board. So development is just ratcheting up in the neighborhood, which is so close to the downtown that its property value is quite high. So it's ratcheting up in the neighborhood. And what we're trying to do is, you know, claim at least some small spaces where we can launch our fight back from, and so abandoned properties and corners that haven't yet been developed and challenging those condo developments that are going up. But it's a hard battle because it's happening quite quickly. And at the same time, we see services being pushed out of the area. So a really popular drop-in at the corner of Dundas and Sherbourne, we had to fight to keep it open because the city was going to close it down. A harm reduction shelter on George Street called the Schoolhouse, the city was going to close it down, and we launched a campaign for a year just to keep that one shelter open, which is 55 beds. And now the shelter beside it, Seton House, which is the largest men's hostel in Canada, is under threat. So, and they're talking about, again, this language of revitalization, and, you know, things are so hard on George Street. There's so many users and people walking around, and so we have to revitalize it and mix up the income of the neighborhood, which our response to them is always, you know, you talk about mixing up the income of the downtown east, but you never talk about mixing up the income of Rosedale, which is the richest neighborhood in Toronto.
Speaking of which, I want to both ask you, because this idea of gentrification and displacement is very much along sort of class lines, but housing sort of always gets not placed in a broader context in terms of both how important gentrification is to local capitalism at this moment in terms of where people can make profits, who gets to decide who gets to live where, and who's forced to live out where. When you just said that, you know, they never talk about Rosedale being sort of a mixed sort of income, or, you know, let's change it up in Rosedale. How do both of your groups sort of present it in a larger frame in terms of, you know, sort of a broader struggle around, you know, the power of capacity of poor people, of working class people, to be able to live in neighborhoods with dignity?
I mean, I think the first thing to say is that the concept of a mixed income neighborhood or of social mixity is actually a lie. Social mixity as a concept really means a kind of a friendly move towards a rich neighborhood, a displacement with a positive face on it, and the main ideological mechanism for that process is what municipal politicians call favorizing access to property. So, you know, the theory behind it is kind of that, you know, poor people will live next to middle-income people, and they'll see that, you know, you can be a sort of full and engaged citizen if you own your own home, as opposed to the sort of, like, disenfranchised marginality of being a tenant. This is the line of municipal administrations, and what this actually does is that it turns everyone into a player of the stock market, because in fact the housing market is a kind of physical manifestation of the stock market with all its contradictions and incoherencies, and contributes to the systematic indebtedness and long-term destruction of those neighborhoods in the physical sense. By systematic indebtedness, I mean the fact that people are encouraged to live beyond their means in a way that would be incredibly frowned upon for any major world government, but in fact are encouraged to do so by the government because the housing market and the securities trade market is entirely dependent on that consumer debt. So the program that we have here in Montreal is called Accès Condo. You know, you see those ads in the metro all the time. You know, if you can scrape together $1,000, then the city will help you essentially put enough down on a condo that the Canada Mortgage and Housing Corporation will guarantee your mortgage with the bank. And what we see happening in St. Henry actually is that a lot of people who are sort of in their 30s or 40s who want to stay in the neighborhood, who can't find an apartment to rent, have you know, have went for that bait and find themselves in an impossible financial situation that they can't maintain. So they've been forced to move out of the neighborhood and to become landlords to rent out those tenants. We see more and more tenants who come to see us, you know, who are having problems with their landlords, are tenants who live in condos. And when you live in a condo, not as the owner, really we find that there's a systematic inability to get repairs done, to do anything, because of course the owner actually maybe even has less money than you do, and they certainly don't have the means to do the necessary repairs, especially in buildings that were constructed shoddily, that are buildings that were constructed in say 2008 or 2009 that are actually falling apart in front of our eyes now, and the long-term impact on the neighborhood is that, you know, a place that had maybe say, just make up a number, 500 landlords, in 10 years is going to have 2,000 landlords. And none of those landlords will be able to do any of the repairs. And in fact, you know, in the sort of cyclical process of capitalism eating itself and then giving birth to something new and disgusting, these neighborhoods will once again become you know, places where nobody dares to go, you know, and then, you know, we'll start the process again of talking about social mixity and transforming the neighborhoods into a place where people can be, you know, quote unquote, safe.
Lisa, I just wanted to ask you, because in a place like Toronto where, you know, where you even have what it has meant for people who are tenants who are struggling to fight against both, you know, this ravaging condominium market, but what has it meant for in terms of beyond just social housing, but people who are actually forced to sort of to rent and, you know, are in terms of the access to low rent or affordable rent in a city like Toronto, and where does it force people to actually to move to?
Right. So, I mean, one thing I just wanted to say around the mixed income argument, this idea that wealth brings civility, and I think anyone looking, following the situation in Toronto right now with our mayor, a billionaire mayor, and his, you know, by all definitions, lack of civility, right? So I just wanted to point that out quickly. But, yeah, I think that there's been a massive loss of rental vacancies and affordable housing, you know, the de facto affordable housing that ends up happening, especially in this neighborhood, with rooming houses. And the rooming houses get bought up as the gentrification comes in, and you see a loss of that rental market. And so our rental vacancy rate in Toronto is actually under 2%. And the vacancy rate within the condos, you know, as they're going up, they're not actually being bought up in the same rate that is speculated upon. I mean, it depends where they're built, but for the most part, they're not being bought up in the same rate that the speculators would want. And so I think there's something like 18% of condos, current condo developments, are empty, sitting empty. And then an even greater rate of that is the people who own them are not even living within them. And similar to what Fred is saying about people renting from condo owners. What we're facing in Ontario also is that people who move into newer developments aren't even protected with rental rights. So they have no right to see their rent only raised by two. We have no rent control in Ontario either, which was slashed under Harris in the 90s. But in theory, landlords are only allowed to raise rent by a certain percentage a year that's agreed upon. But within the condo developments and any new developments after, I think it's 2003, that doesn't apply. So people don't have the same rights within that system and can't take things to the landlord-tenant board in the same way that other people in other developments would be able to. And then on top of that, the pressure coming around the social housing, which is that we have about 90,000, just over 90,000 households on the waiting list for social housing in the city of Toronto, which is, that list is about 10 years long. So, and then we've seen the city of Toronto under Ford looking at trying to sell off that social housing stock at a time where we have a housing crisis. So we're in a very serious state in the city of Toronto, to the point where our homeless shelters are beyond capacity. They're well over 99%, 100% capacity. We're heading into the winter. And so part of what we're having to find ourselves arguing for is that the city open up new shelter spaces, because the housing crisis is so terrible and so bad, and they're selling off housing stock, and there is no rental units available, that we are demanding that shelter be opened at the same time that we obviously demand affordable and accessible housing. But the shelters themselves aren't even enough to hold people in the winter months. So we're in a very serious state of crisis.
I want to move on quickly to sort of to the responses and to the sort of the organizing against it, which has been inspiring, and sort of seeing similar actions in both in Montreal and Toronto. And maybe start with you, Fred, and just talking about sort of the idea and the concept of Aqui La Ville and the action that was taking place over a particular kind of slumlord, Sargakis. And maybe if you can just talk about it and sort of the concept behind it and sort of the idea of what Aqui La Ville is trying to actually to achieve.
Sure. I mean, one of the main demands of housing committees and tenants associations in Montreal over the last several years has been putting in place what we call a tax reserve, creating a land reserve, essentially that the city buy up empty lots and empty buildings and take them off the speculative market, because it is the speculative process that drives up property value in the neighborhoods and then consequently drives up everyone's rent. And, you know, the way that we have done that in the last 6 months is through a series of rotating squats of empty lots. We did Peter Sargakis, as you alluded to, is a notorious slumlord in downtown and in the southwest of the city, who had a couple of empty lots in the southwest of Montreal that he's just been sitting on, which, by the way, have, you know, tripled in their value since he bought them. And we, you know, we occupied that territory for about a week and a half, and then later the same thing was done in Hochelaga-Maisonneuve in the east of the city for even a longer time. And this is a demand that that we're starting to see some progress on. In the southwest, the administration has just purchased two lots for social housing. I mean, it's just a beginning, but this is something that has been taken up not only by the community sector, but by a lot of folks who came out, who were politicized during the strike, who have been moving into anti-gentrification struggles. Notably, the popular neighborhood assemblies are organizing a lot around gentrification and around this type of action. Other things that we've been doing include the foundation of a Southwest Solidarity Network, based on a model of mutual aid and direct action. So both for folks working in restaurants and businesses in the neighborhood and for tenants. Our most recent struggle was a worker who had been fired without severance pay from a yuppie restaurant that, you know, that sells pizza at $30 a slice or whatever. You know, we went there last week with a delegation of 30 people, delivered a letter demanding that he be paid, and we found out yesterday that he had been paid the full $350. So it's a collective struggle that you know, that we're taking very seriously, and I think we're reaching the point now where you know, we can't play around. In St. Henry specifically, is if the process is not stopped here and now, you know, in 5 years it'll be too late. St. Henry will no longer be a working class community.
And Lisa, if you can talk about, I mean, in OCAP just recently, this past September, there was also a squat action, you know, Take It Back. If you can just talk about sort of, you know, what OCAP strategy was around that particular action, and in terms of trying to stop the process of gentrification in the downtown East End.
Sure. So we've been responding to a lot of cuts that have been coming down within the neighborhood. So as I said, around the schoolhouse shelter, around the Friendship Center drop-in, around Seton House, around, you know, a couple of the services that have been threatened, specifically shelters, in the neighborhood, and so constantly responding to cuts coming on services and shelters. And so this fall, we've been talking for a long time about the empty properties that remain in the neighborhood, and what used to be here, and the encroachment that's been coming. And within all of our struggles where we've been trying to save the services, we've obviously been continuing to put forward the demands for housing and to be built and repaired in the neighborhood. And so this fall, instead of constantly responding, we sort of started taking. And so we targeted a house at the corner, a house and two abandoned properties, two lots, at the corner of Dundas and Sherbourne, so a really vital center, which, if that property was turned into housing, would be a real marker of this is our neighborhood, we're keeping it, people aren't moving out. And so we targeted this house, 230 Sherbourne, that we named Drina's House, because of the fact that in the 80s, a woman named Drina Joubert was found frozen to death behind this same house. So we thought, in honor of her memory and those people who are forced to sleep outside, and in light of the crisis happening within the shelter system, that naming this house Drina's House would be appropriate. And so we took over both the house and the abandoned lot beside it, and put out a call to the city that they expropriate that property, all three of those properties, that it be turned in immediately into Drina's House, and that beside it be turned into housing and services for the community. And so we launched within it a conversation with people in the neighborhood about what would you want to see. So there's been conversations about that we need a safe consumption site at the corner, that we need a 24-hour drop-in, that we need housing for Aboriginal elders and housing for women, and safe spaces for women to go. And so it launched a conversation about what would we want to see in the neighborhood, and what's our, the people's development proposal that's taking back these properties. So this is one of the properties that we targeted. We certainly looked at and have created a map of all of the properties in the neighborhood that are currently empty, that used to be either, there's a bar, that what used to be a Bar Canada House at the corner of Queen and Sherbourne, that we've also targeted and said that needs to be transformed and turned into housing. So we're going piece by piece, and it's certainly looking at it as a long-term campaign, but trying to mark the space, and this is where we're not going to move from here. So that's the Taking It Back campaign as it is right now, and we're going to the city in December to bring the demands for both that house and also around shelter space in the neighborhood.
We ran out of time, but thank you so much, both Lisa and Fred. And if people want to get involved with OCAP, the Ontario Coalition Against Poverty, or here in Montreal, the Southwest Solidarity Network, how can people get in touch?
For us, you can email, you can check our website, which is salsudwest.net, or you can send us an email at info@salsudwest.net.
For us, just go to the website, ocap.ca, or email us, ocap@tao.ca. You can phone us, but be long distance for you guys.
Thank you very much, Fred and Lisa. And hopefully more inspiring struggles to come in the year 2014 to try to take back housing for all. You're listening to CKUT here off the hour, Friday, November the 8th, on CKUT, www.ckut.ca, on the web, 90.3.